Journalist Michael Dobbs's new book, King Richard, Nixon, and Watergate, An American Tragedy, is an account of the crucial days, hours, and moments when the Watergate conspiracy consumed and toppled a president. Drawing on thousands of hours of newly released tape recordings, Dobbs recreates these traumatic events in detail, capturing the growing paranoia of the principal players and their desperate attempts to deflect blame, creating a unprecedented vivid portrait of a president facing his greatest crisis. Michael Dobbs is a longtime reporter for The Washington Post, covering the collapse of communism as a foreign correspondent. He has taught at Princeton, Georgetown, and the University of Michigan. His new book is King Richard, Nixon and Watergate, An American Tragedy. And we welcome Michael Dobbs to the roundtable this morning. Michael, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Give us a sense of what brought you to this subject and wanting to write about Nixon.
Well, I'm a former journalist, and I actually work for the Washington Post. I've always been interested in presidential crises, and I think there's no crisis that we can now get a more intimate, close-up look than Nixon's handling of Watergate. His tapes are an extraordinary resource. No future president, of course, is ever going to tape himself the way Nixon did. So we're able to see day by day, minute by minute, how his presidency unraveled. And I chose to focus on the 100 days after his second inaugural. He had a 67% approval rating when he swore the oath of office for the second time. And within 3 months, his presidency had fallen apart. So I was interested in that period of time.
When did he start to realize deeply that he was in trouble in that 100 days?
Right. Well, I think sort of midway through, as his aides, they'd all been part of an extremely disciplined presidency, whipped into shape by his chief of staff, Bob Haldeman. They all began turning on each other, trying to save themselves. Of course, the most well-known one is John Dean, who was the legal counsel, who realized that he was in legal peril. But one after another, they turned on each other and then eventually turned on the president. So it was about March or April of 1973 that Nixon understood that his presidency was in deep trouble.
One of the things that is fascinating about the book is because it's titled King Richard, and you look at it as an American tragedy. And there is that King Richard look to it in the sense that this was a guy who thought of himself as a king, right?
Right. In fact, he was named after an English King Richard, the Crusader King, by his mother, who had great expectations for him. So this sort of King Richard is a reference to his mother's expectations, but also, of course, to one of Shakespeare's tragedies, King Lear. And so I tell it in the form of a tragedy. But there's, and of course, it's not exactly parallel to a Shakespearean tragedy. It has several American twists to it. But that's the basic idea of this extremely powerful man who's brought down by his own fatal flaws.
There is the Gary Wills quote that the real tragedy is that he never had the stature to be a tragic hero. Would you agree with that?
Only partially, because I think actually that the tapes end up doing a service to Nixon, because you can see his private torment during this period. You can see the possibilities of his presidency, and also you can see the tragedy of it all coming down in wreckage. And you can also see the pain that he suffered. I include a scene of him parting with Bob Haldeman, his chief of staff, and Nixon is practically crying. He's calling Haldeman my brother, a reference to his own brother, who died of tuberculosis when Nixon was a young man. I mean, Nixon took these things to heart, and I think actually that's one contrast between him and Trump. Trump went through four chiefs of staff in 4 years, and Nixon found it very painful to part ways even with one chief of staff.
Of course, 3,700 hours of tape recordings were released to the public in 2013. You really delve into those, and they provided quite a bit to this volume.
They did, because, you know, they provide insights into Nixon's character, enable a writer to follow him around the White House day by day. And there's also incredible dialogue in the tapes. I mean, I've tried to tell this story the way a novelist might structure a novel. And, of course, the only difference is that a nonfiction writer has to be completely accurate. And the tapes are an incredible source of real dialogue that it's practically impossible for a fiction writer to dream up.
And because of that, there is a real intimacy between, well, the reader and the subject, who is Richard Nixon, who is speaking on those tapes and the conversation he's having. So there is a that very much a fly-on-the-wall aspect.
Yeah, I think so. I felt that I was a fly on the wall, and I'm encouraging readers to also think of themselves as a fly on the wall. I think we're two flies on the wall in these places that ordinary mortals never get to go, and that's one of the attractions of writing about history as opposed to current politics, is that we can access scenes that, you know, normally would be completely off limits to us, such as the Oval Office, the Camp David, the Lincoln sitting room, which was Nixon's favorite room in the White House, and we can see how politics actually works as opposed to the public relations image that presidents want to project.
You write about a Richard Nixon who, of course, had his flaws coming into this defined timetable that you are looking at. He was always obsessed with his legacy, which I guess sets up the point of why he wanted to have a taping system in the first place, which was installed in 1971.
Right. In fact, he had begun by ripping out LBJ's taping system. LBJ just taped some of his telephone calls. But after a couple of years, Nixon decided that he needed tapes, some kind of taping system, in order to write his memoirs. I mean, he wanted to get the credit for all his foreign policy initiatives, not to allow uppity subordinates like Henry Kissinger to claim the credit. So he decided to put in his own taping system, and the difference with the previous taping systems in the White House was that Nixon's taping system didn't have an on-off switch. Mm. It just began whenever Nixon went into the room, and that turned out to be the instrument of Nixon's destruction.
So meanwhile, while he is taping, quote-unquote, secretly, by the time that the Senate votes to establish a committee to investigate Watergate, all the people around him, or many of the people around him, start taping their conversations too.
That's right. I mean, that's something that I hadn't previously been aware of, at least the extent to which that was happening. I mean, Haldeman began taping people, John Dean did, Ehrlichman, and they all wanted to use the tapes to prove their innocence. So you really get a picture of a White House where all these people who were meant to be working together had in fact become enemies and had knives out for each other and rival tapes that they could put on the table of prosecutors. And, you know, it's that process that I was interested in examining.
And everybody is at this point looking out for themselves. I mean, you write at one point in the book, events begin to speed up like the final scenes of an elaborate Broadway farce.
Yeah, there's a sort of humorous side to this, if it wasn't so serious. But, yeah, I mean, there's some weekends in the White House where, you know, one person is coming in to see Nixon, another person is running out the door, and they're all plotting against each other. So it did remind me of a Broadway farce in parts.
And how much of that was the speed, I guess, of which I'm interested in, is that this became a runaway train at some point?
Yep. I think it was precisely in this period that it became a runaway train and impossible to stop. And Nixon tried his darndest. You know, he never gave up, but it really ran away with him, and particularly after the culminating moment, of course, was when the existence of those tape recordings became public knowledge. I think Nixon could have got away with it had he not been forced to give up the tapes, but it was the tapes in the end, when they became public, that brought him down.
Michael Dobbs is our guest. The new book is King Richard, Nixon and Watergate, an American Tragedy. For you as a writer and as a journalist, tackling a subject that, of course, has been written so thoroughly about, you have found your place here. And I'm curious as to how much you look at what's around you and what has already been written.
You mean other Watergate books?
Yes.
Well, I tried to write it for a new generation that, perhaps people who didn't follow Watergate, after all, Watergate is now 50 years old. But the other thing that distinguishes my book, I think, from others is that I focus on a very defined period, so I can get more intimate with the subject than it's possible if you're trying to, you know, tell the entire story of Nixon's life or even the entire story of Watergate. In this case, I think that less is more because, you know, I'm able to follow him on a day-to-day basis and use materials that have, although they've been out there for a number of years, have never really been used effectively before by a Nixon biographer.
In the New York Times recently called "Was Richard Nixon a Tragic Hero?" This was written about your book by David Greenberg, and I'm curious of your thoughts on that idea of Nixon being a tragic hero.
Right. Well, my book is structured to present him as a tragic hero. It's called King Richard. It's sort of modeled on a Shakespearean or Greek tragedy. I do think it has an American twist to the end because the hero doesn't die. He lives on and he continues to try to redeem and rehabilitate himself. It's not a Shakespearean tragedy. It's an American drama. Mm. I do disagree with David Greenberg. I do think there are tragic elements to Nixon. I think you discover that if you begin to look at him sort of day by day as closely as I did. I mean, that's one of the purposes of the book. I think there's a whole generation of people who have sort of grown up thinking of Nixon as a bit of a cardboard caricature. And there's much more to the man than that.
But that comes from that feeling of looking at him that way, comes from his deep flaws, right? I mean, of looking at how difficult it was and really how it seems, not to be overly psychological, but deeply unhappy he was.
Right. Well, of course, he's a man of deep, tragic flaws. Nobody is disputing that. At least I'm not disputing it. But he was also a man of great talents. I mean, I think that his flaws match his talents. I mean, I say in the book that he's like, actually his first campaign slogan was "One of Us," i.e. meaning that he was a regular American.
Right.
I think in some ways he does display the traits of regular Americans, only in much greater quantity. I mean, he hated people with much greater intensity. He dreamed bigger dreams. And he fell from a greater height. But I think many Americans can identify themselves with someone like Nixon, who, you know, rose from virtually nothing to become president of the United States and then lost it all as a result of his own mistakes. This is not a man like Trump, who, you know, was born on third base. Nixon was born in dirt poor family out in California, and he scrambled all his way to the top with very little assistance from other people.
Let us talk about how you present the book, which I think is really interesting, because you do it in a chronological fashion. You start in that, really, those 100 days and go through. Did that work for you at the very beginning, or did you sort of happen upon that approach?
Well, as I say, I was thinking, you know, in terms of a structure of a Shakespeare play. So the first section is hubris. And actually, the book begins with a conversation between Colson and Nixon on the night of his second inaugural, in which they're plotting how they're going to get back at all their enemies, including the Washington Post, where I used to work. So they feel right at the top of their game, and then this all quickly unravels, partly as a result of the discovery that perjury has been committed in the Watergate trial. So I go from hubris, Act One, through crisis, catastrophe, and catharsis right at the end. So I thought of, I structured it, you know, right from the beginning, like a tragedy.
You write at the end of the book that the idea for the book originated with a conversation that you had with Stanley Cutler, who you refer to, rightfully so, as the Dean of Watergate Historians just before his death. You were working at the Post. What what did that conversation leave you with of the thoughts of where you wanted to go?
Well, as you say, Cutler was the Dean of Watergate Historians and was deeply involved in all the intricacies of Watergate. And I called him up. And I thought we were going to have a discussion about the tapes or, you know, some minor character in Watergate. And he surprised me by saying that in 20 years, all these Watergate characters, John Dean, all the others, will be forgotten. And the only one anyone will remember will be Nixon himself, and he will endure forever. So lost in the sight of this, you know, in the mass of all these Watergate details is the personality and character of Richard Nixon. So I wanted to focus on Nixon himself, which is why I called the book King Richard, and is another reason that I think distinguishes my book from other Watergate books, where, you know, all these characters and the intricacies of the plot, they meant something to us 50 years ago, but they don't so much anymore. Mm. The one character that has endured is Nixon himself.
And it's interesting you say that because just within not that long ago, G. Gordon Liddy passes away, and you see how he is remembered, and it's a strange legacy.
Right. Well, Liddy was an extraordinary person, and what is, you know, the real question is why crazy people like Liddy were allowed to do what they were able to do. They sort of ran with the ball with very little supervision. Actually, Liddy reminded me in some respects of the people who broke into the Capitol on January the 6th. He felt so betrayed by the anti-war movement and the liberals and the hippies back in the 60s that he felt justified to take any measure, including illegal measures, to defend his president, Richard Nixon. And I think we saw the same kind of syndrome in the months after the last election.
Without mentioning names, certainly presidents that have come since have fared better in the immediate moment of history because of Donald Trump. How do you think that leaves Nixon?
I think, you know, Nixon has, up until Donald Trump, I mean, I think that most historians would have put Nixon very low on the list of historical presidents, perhaps right at the bottom. But I think there's been some reassessment since the Trump presidency. I mean, Nixon would never have contested the result of an election. There was a much closer election in 1960 when he lost to John Kennedy, and he had some cause for complaint back in 1960. I mean, a few thousand votes in Illinois would have made the difference. But although he was unhappy about that result, he did not take any steps to contest it. Of course, it fed into his general hatred of the Kennedys and his hatred of the establishment. So you can see there's a line between that and Watergate. But Nixon, you know, didn't contest any election. And in that sense, he was in the mainstream of American presidents. I think that Trump is outside of the mainstream of American presidents, including Nixon.
I'm fascinated by what you said a moment ago of presenting this story to a new generation, a generation that has Trump as context. So a variation on the question I just asked, I guess, but how does that how does that context, do you think, add to the story for all of us about the presidency of Richard Nixon?
The context of living in the age of Trump.
Yes.
Well, of course, I wrote the book in the age of Trump, so I was constantly reminded of all these parallels and contrasts. And you can, you know, draw a line between Nixon and Trump in many respects. Elements of his political strategy, it was called the Southern Strategy in those days, playing the race card, the identity politics, Nixon whipping up his so-called silent majority, his hatred of the press, pursuit of enemies, and so on and so forth. So there are similarities, but there are also significant differences. I mean, Nixon, to my mind, was a much more substantive president than Trump. He thought deeply about American history, foreign policy. He had significant foreign policy achievements. And he also has this capacity for suffering that we don't see in Trump. So I regard, you know, Nixon has tragic potential. And perhaps people will change their views about Trump, but I personally don't see it in Trump at the moment.
The name of the book is King Richard Nixon and Watergate, an American Tragedy. It is by Michael Dobbs. The book is published by Knopf. Michael, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you for the fascinating read and for the conversation this morning. I greatly appreciate it.
Well, thank you. It's been lovely to be with you.
And to you. Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book, King Richard Nixon and Watergate, an American Tragedy by Michael Dobbs. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.